It's time to give away free vaulting poles. That's right. The month of January of 2024, Gill's National Pacer Pole Promo is live. Buy three poles, get one free. That's right. Free vaulting poles for your program. Call your authorized, preferred Gill Athletics dealer today, and let's help you fill out your pole vaulting inventory. Free pole is equal or lesser value of all poles.
World, you are now tuned in to our humble servant, Mike Cunningham, for another extraordinary message on Gill Athletics Connections.
All right, welcome back to the Gill Athletics Connections Track and Field Podcast. You know, we've been following along here. We're doing a very special to kick off season five Baylor 4x4 series, right? Baylor 4x4U, we just had to do four in a row. We started with our lead leg, the current director of track and field, Mike Ford. He was awesome. If you haven't listened, you got to go back right now. And then we went to Jeremy Warner. Say no more. I don't know what else I need to say. And really the amazing transition that he has gone to for high school coaching. Doing an awesome job. And today, you know, if you're watching on YouTube, he's actually kind of wearing a Baylor green. He's
got
some green on.
I
appreciate that. You've seen it
up not on purpose.
The title of the episode today. Help me welcome the CEO, my big boss, I like to call him, from Gill Athletics, the wise, the wonderful Mr. David Hogg. David, how are you?
I'm doing real well. Thank you. Thanks for having me. I guess I was due.
You know, we're only episode 240 something. So sure.
Yeah. I've dodged you 240 times.
First, I got to say, you know, this doesn't happen without you.
Oh,
you know, you've got to bless the things that I do here in this company. And, you know, I've showed you some of the feedback we've had from the podcast. And, it is worthy in that sense of you uplifting and honoring coaches around the world. And so, you know, I always remind people when they ask me about, you know, how I got into this side of, and it's like, you know, if I don't have the support of a David, Steve, and many others, this literally doesn't happen.
You're very kind.
Thank you. Appreciate
you've done a great job. I'm really proud of you. This has been a really neat series. It kind of just took on a life of its own. So that's fantastic job. That's
well, thank you for that. Yeah. So today we're doing third leg. Did you ever run the third leg of a 4x4?
You know, I anchored a lot of them in high school. I don't know if I ran a third leg.
Well, that's good because next week we anchor. So we
there you go.
4x4
with the anchor.
I'm pretty sure no one knows this yet, but so I'm gonna go ahead and. Yeah, I'm going to let the cat out of the bag. So next week.
Yeah.
So Michael Ford, Jeremy Warner, David Hopp. We're going to find out about some. There's a 400 meter.
It's going to be a big drop.
And then we're going to Clyde Hart.
Yeah. The man.
And let me tell you, you know, it's already in the cans. We've already had this. It's amazing. You know, we'll share some Clyde Hart stories today. His journey is quite amazing. And I'm going to say what I allowed him. It was quite hard. He could have told me anything. I let him do anything. We don't talk X's and O's on the podcast.
I promise not to.
Yeah, I haven't coached him.
Might be financial statements or something like that.
So we don't talk for X's and O's and stuff like that. But Clyde wanted to talk about some of the Baylor way, the Clyde Hart way. And I was like, yes, sir. We'll get into it. So we even get into some 400 meter training, which I was starting writing notes. I'm like, I think I can push 400.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Well, today we're going to focus on you, David. And, you know, you are our CEO, our president here at Gill Athletics. And, you know, I've mentioned this a few times on the podcast. Gill is much bigger than just Gill. Most people here listening know about track and field and Gill, but our sister company, Porter Athletics, so basketball and volleyball. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, our outdoor construction, so baseball, tennis, football goals, you imagine it. And you oversee it all, which I'm sure the number one question most people have is, how do you manage Mike Cunningham?
Wow. You know, I always tell people they ask me about my leadership style. I'm really, I would consider myself kind of a Reagan manager. I don't know if you know what that means, but it's just basically laissez-faire. You know, we try to hire good people and try to clear the path for their success. And so, you know, if I'm micromanaging somebody, they're probably not in good shape. I really like to just, again, set people free that are, you know, they're already, again, get good people, but really just, I try to remove obstacles in their way of success and watch them succeed. And that's really kind of been the way I've gone about it. Yeah.
And so you've had to really micromanage me.
No, you know, it's really, honestly, you have, you know, there are people who are hunters, you know, that they're just self, they're driven, they're focused, they're self-starters. And Mike, obviously you're in that category in spades. So it really depends on where the person, where they are in their life and what their makeup is. And you got to kind of tailor it to that. So for you, you kind of, you know, you founded this company through customer service and sales and business development now and all that you do. And so really, you've kind of found your way. And it's not anything too strategic on like, I think Mike will eventually be this someday. It's more of like, hey, where would he fit in where we're going?
Thank you. And, you know, that happens because leaders shine the light on that path. Mm-hmm. The path may not be written. So
maybe,
you know, there's many people that could and maybe should also be in the seat in regards to my development here.
Yeah.
Steve Vogel saying my boss, you know, Fred Dixon.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Here, now retired. So, you know, I always tell our coaches, you know, they stand on the shoulders of other giants.
Right.
It's the same with me with here. So thank you.
And me as well.
Okay. Well, no one came here to actually listen to me though. So let's get into you. You know, Gill Athletics, one of the unique parts of us compared to others out there is track and field is our DNA. You know, you cut us, hurdles bleed out. You know, myself as a former coach, we've had Jennifer Vanderlot on the show, you know, former Division I All-American thrower and Division I coach. At this point, Tim Glover has been on the show, you know, top 10 javelin thrower and many others, from customer service to shipping. It's quite amazing how former track athletes, track coaches that we've had here. So you're the head honcho, you're the CEO. Tell me you've done some track. What's track look like for you?
Yeah, it's boy, it starts way back, and you don't have enough time for all that. But when I was a little, you know, just I grew up in a place called Mount Vernon, Illinois, the southern part of the state of Illinois, and actually went to grade school, a little town called in Dix, Illinois, D-I-X, Illinois, and at a Rome grade school. And there was a guy there that was a real track nut. It was Coach Burns, Coach Jim Burns. He actually just passed this year, and he was a wonderful guy, but he had a real bend for track and field and cross country. And so it was kind of the sport you all, you know, there were probably 30 kids in my eighth grade class or my fifth grade class or fourth grade class, whatever it was. And you did track and field because that's what we did at PE class. And so that's really kind of where it started. And I started pole vaulting and hurdling very early on. And Coach Burns just really gave me a love for the sport. And he would take me like he would take me to a high school track meet, like the conference meet in Mount Vernon. They were in the South 7 Conference, which is the largest schools in the southern part of the state. But I got to hold the string for the finish line. We used to hold the string. We used to have string.
So you weren't in high school. I
was in probably sixth grade.
We're going to introduce you to the next level.
So somehow he saw something in me and just said, come on, David. And I think a buddy went with me and we got to hold the string of the conference meet, which was obviously a huge impact seeing these. Well, yeah, they were all like three times my size. I was teeny. And it was just, you know, the level of athleticism for me was just, oh my goodness. So that's really the seed probably went in there.
Were you doing, you mentioned pole vault. Were you doing pole vault?
Yeah. Pole vaulting a bamboo pole onto sawdust. And actually in my backyard, there wasn't even that. We just would dig up the ground a little bit so we wouldn't break your ankles on the way down. So I had the neighborhood record, 7'4" neighborhood record.
No,
fifth grade.
A long time now. I knew all the things. I did not know. I just imagined you were fiberglass from day one.
Oh, no.
Bamboo?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Bamboo. And then we got to go to aluminum and Swedish steel. Some of the really early things that were going on was kind of cool. And then I think the very first pole, fiberglass pole, was a Browning Sky pole. It was a brown pole. Yeah. And so we had neighborhood championships, and I was actually in all athletics. My best sport was probably basketball, and then I played baseball as well, and played football in high school too. But nevertheless, it always seemed like I would gravitate back toward track and field.
What, you know, that's interesting as an kind of an all around athlete playing all these other
sports,
and you know, typically even back then on TV, you're not seeing track. There was more maybe back then there is now, but you certainly were seeing basketball, baseball. Your heroes might've been a football player, et cetera.
Sure.
What kept you, it's kind of interesting when your face, when you said that you kept coming back, track almost like was pulling you back. What was it about track?
Yeah, I think probably like a lot of track athletes, you know, it's wonderful to, I love the journey of track. I do love the competition. That's great. But boy, I love measured success and mapping out my workouts and watching my diet and being, you know, just, I just love the kind of what a lot of track and field and cross country athletes love to do. They just methodically love that kind of style. And I love team sports too. And like I said, I couldn't have told you I was going to try to be a college track athlete when I was young, even in high school. I was going to wait and see which one was going to go kind of the best. And track and field became my best sport.
What was your other?
Probably basketball, like a small school basketball or, you know, something. I was not an awesome, I was an all conference kind of basketball guy. I was not a.
You played basketball all 4 years?
I did. Yeah.
So you were coming off, you had kind of a short track season.
I did.
You know, basketball.
I did. I never did an indoor, but yeah, I was a point guard on one of the top teams in Illinois. Yeah.
So what, you mentioned some of the events you did back in grade school when coach brought you in. What were some of the main events you started gravitating towards as you went through high school?
Yeah. You know, it's really funny. I was really into cross country too. I was, you know, kind of the county champion in the whatever. I think we did a mile and a half when we were in seventh grade or maybe two. I don't know. But yeah, and you know, I even ran the half mile some like when I was, but you know, I was a hurdler pretty early on, and then I was also a pole vaulter pretty early on. And then I would just kind of learn, again, my coach was Coach Burns. It was really amazing. The people have been put in my life. The coaches have been so impactful. I just can't tell you enough what that meant. And he told me one time in my hurdling, I was very small and just didn't grow until I got late into high school. I even grew in college. I know it's crazy. But we would run the hurdles, the 100-yard, 110-yard hurdles, wherever they were at the time. And I could alternate both legs. And so my coach said, you know, if you can cut out a step per, instead of going like seven steps, you do sixes or whatever you do, you know. And I really took that. And so I lengthened my stride a bit so that I could take one less step between hurdles just because it helped me again be more competitive. Right. So, and I ran the 100 meters too. So probably the hurdles, 100 meters, and probably the pole vaulting were the ones that stayed around. And then I would long jump in those things too. So.
See, I think that's why you and I get along. So, you know, the top two events, and we won't argue which one's number one, is number two, but we know hurdles is number one.
And the hurdles and pole
vaults. You did both.
There you go.
Where I grew up. You know, there was no pole vaults. We had hurdles, and you know, we did those very poorly. You know, I had to take out 10 steps to get close to being respectful.
That's great.
So, you know, it's interesting. We talked about Coach Burns. It sounded like he gave you a lot of variety of events. And up to that point, through high school here, you know, playing all these different sports and other activities. So you had a lot of different coaches.
I did.
Throughout. So
I did.
Had a lot of different styles.
Sure.
What was it about Coach Burns? Was he, you know, there's authoritarian type of coaches, you know,
sure.
Get out there and
sure.
Do this. There's, you know, gentle, loving coaches.
Sure.
What was the style?
I've had all kinds of coaches, and I would say I probably gravitated more toward Coach Burns, was much more of a come alongside guy and give you opportunity, encourage you, those kind of guys. And you know, I transitioned from a Coach Burns who was close friends to the high school coach at Malvern named Sonny Ellis. And he also just passed in not too long ago. And Sonny was a pole vaulter at SIU, actually, back when he was, I couldn't tell what years it was, but it was way back. And he was also very passionate about the pole vault as well. And Coach Ellis, staying on the right path, Coach Ellis also was a very, very much a guy who he would work. He would lift weights with me. He would come and pick me up. He saw something. It was amazing. When I was a little guy, I lived about 2 or 3 miles from him. He would come in the summertime from my freshman year to my senior year, and he'd pick me up in the morning. And we'd drive, he and just the two of us. I was 5 foot tall, 90 pounds. No kidding.
I believe
it's true. Yeah. And somehow why this guy did this, right. The head coach, and drive me to lift weights together at Mount Vernon in the basement there. And then my dad would stop on the way, and I had to work. My dad was an engineer in the architectural business. And so I had to work as a draftsman for him. My dad would pick me up on the way to work, swing by and pick me up from the gym. And Coach Ellis would stay, and some more athletes would come, a few, but he would come and get me. And It was amazing. And he really, see what I've always, my strength has always been good for my body weight, you know, strength too. And I still look back to that seeing that we worked out hard. So I think finally my basketball coach also in high school was a guy who just gave me a great opportunity. Same kind of guy. He was probably a little tougher, but he was really very, you know, they're all bright guys. They were all able to see something in you that maybe you didn't see in yourself. And the authoritarian thing with some coaches, I know that can work. With me, I probably would have, you know, I kind of see through that. You know, if that's what it takes to get me motivated, then we got real trouble. But I think those coaches were just those who kind of put, again, that kind of showed you the way and really made you believe that you were better than you really were.
You know, the real, and I hear this story all the time, the real superpower of a track coach is being able to see something in you mm-hmm. before you can see it in yourself. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. given that story, it's like, oh, yeah, I see what these coaches were doing. They're like,
absolutely.
And they couldn't probably put words to it either. Mm-hmm. Just like, no, I need to be doing this for this kid.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I had a college coach, like Coach Erickson, not just Coach Hart, who was, we'll talk about later, but Coach Carl Erickson. I believe the success I had in college was a lot through psychology and him. I just, he made me think I was invincible and I wasn't, but he made me think that I was the best in the world. And I think I started trying to play that out. Right. You know, I didn't know any better.
Yeah. That's interesting. So stay with me on pole vaulting in high school first. Then we're going to go to 300 hurdling on here. You know, I do know some of the stories. There was I'll say unique. It seemed like there was a unique culture in that area. So not just mm-hmm. you and your school, and maybe there were other athletes from your school, but I know I've heard of some names.
Tim Winder. Oh yeah.
And Sullivan.
Jim Sullivan. Yeah. Sure. Have they been on the show? The both of those guys?
Yes.
They both should be.
Sullivan, Beth Alford.
Oh yeah, right? Of course.
An amazing job. She was awesome.
That's great.
But not those other guys. Just. so there seemed to be a unique culture of pole vaulting.
It was.
I mean, you know, you're down in Mount Vernon. That's, you know, people think Champaign-Urbana is small.
Oh, yeah. It can go less.
Small. What was it about pole vaulting? Mm-hmm. Was there a culture mm-hmm. of coaches that brought these kids in? What was going on?
You know, SIU was a big kind of a coaching, a real it was a great track and field school at the time. Coach Hartzog, you know, they won the mile relay. And they had great teams. Like, David Lee, I think it's David Lee, that he was a medalist in Montreal. I mean, on and on and on.
Quite amazing.
And they had great pole vault culture there. So Jan Johnson, actually, you know, he did his grad work there. And so he did, I think it was Alabama undergrad and did grad work, I think. I think it was grad, not PhD work at SIU. And he had this SIU camp there. And so, and also his brother, Tim Johnson, who was another great vaulter, he qualified for the trials and probably in the 72 trials or whatever it was, 68, probably 72 when I knew him. Anyway, so that really, there were a lot of good vaulters at SIU. And so we would all, and they were very welcoming. And Jan had the camp and they were just, again, a lot of us, Tim Winder and I were like brothers. I mean, we traveled all over there and would go back and forth. We'd have camps at Marion High School, which is close to SIU. And we would just go down every Thursday night. We'd go down and jump and blah, 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 blah. Yeah, it was amazing.
I totally forgot.
Mm-hmm. I think Jan was probably was a big piece of the genesis. Yeah,
Jan,
I think. He moved on then to go to LSU. And that was kind of after. And then after that, I think I left for school too. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so you were, you know, I know of you as a pole vaulter primarily. We'll get into that. But that actually, my understanding, that kind of wasn't really your main event. Like, you were more 300 hurdle, 400.
You know what? I was a intermediate hurdler. The hurdle story is funny. We had, I was a good high hurdler too, which, even though Coach Hart doesn't think that's the case, but we had one of the best high hurdlers in the state on my team. He just kind of kept us, and I was a good vaulter and a good intermediate hurdler, but he only got beat at state by one guy. I beat him in workouts.
Really?
Yeah, seriously. I love the highs. I beat myself to death, but he was really a good hurdler. And so I'd hurdled before And so really, yeah, I was probably equal between the two of them, probably the intermediate hurdles and the pole vault. Probably I really wanted to be a college athlete of both by the time I got a senior year, or after I got to Baylor, I tried right. to keep going. It's just, yeah, I didn't realize the magnitude of a Division One. Yeah. You know, here I am, a walk on a Division One school. It wasn't like I was going right. to be, you know. So it was, that's, yeah, but the hurdles were very important to me. I love them too, because it's a very measured race. The vault and the hurdles are very similar. There's some measurement involved. There's precision involved. And
yeah, knowing you and how you work, it's interesting to hear you talk about precision and the measure. It's like, oh, yeah, I've been in meetings. Okay, well, no surprise. We know, you know, you went to Baylor. Uh-huh. And I've asked you this question before. I love this. Why? So, you know, you're a Southern Illinois kid. There's University of Illinois. There's a million schools between Mount Vernon and Waco, Texas. I believe none of your family are Baylor grads.
No.
It's not like that was an impetus.
Yeah.
Where did you look at, and why Waco, Texas?
Yeah. You know what? I was, it was my senior year, and I really had realized at that point I'd had a great basketball season and all that. But, you know, again, I was at best a small school kind of guy. And track and field is going to be my best shot if I want to continue in athletics. And so I, my senior year, I got out of the blocks really fast. Shouldn't have said that. Got out of the gates really fast. Sorry. Hello. Yeah, here we go. What am I doing? Anyway, got out of the pretty quick. And I jumped. I had a good vault the first week of the season. Again, you just kind of walked off the basketball court and you walked. Right. There really is no training. And then I also had a really good 300 meter time in the hurdles. And so it was going well. And I thought, you know what? Yeah, I've got it. This is great. I set the school record like week two. I was doing, you know, things were kind of falling in place. And then I think week three is when I was out. I drove to Evansville to one of our dealers. I don't think where they're still a dealer, and picked up a pole vaulting pole that I needed. I think it was a Browning Sky pole. No, it was a black catapult that did it. Drove it back. And it was a little too big for me, but I drove back that night and they turned the lights on out at the field at the Mount Vernon High School. So I test the pole out and it slipped on my hands and it broke my hip. It broke about 3 inches off my hip, off the tip of my hip. It came back and smacked me and broke my hip. Dude. So my chances of, you know, I had not done well enough to really get too many looks at that point. So I went from, you know, hopefully getting maybe a lot more looks to, you know, Illinois State recruited me, SIU recruited me, Eastern offered me a scholarship as well. And I was recruited as a decathlete, not as, well, though, yeah, absolutely.
It's a long jump, sure. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so it was a natural. But honestly, it came down to where, and again, my hip was broken, so it hurt to do anything. And so, you know, I got down to where I thought, and then my dad's was a U of I engineer. And so I kind of had three different choices. I could go to U of I and be an engineer with my dad and follow in his business. I could, you know, go ahead and be probably a decathlete or something at a mid-major school in this area. Or I could just really roll the dice and go for the big time. And so I did the latter. And, you know, I knew Baylor had a good track. They were an elite track program at that time. You know what I mean? It wasn't a very big team, but it was just when you had somebody, they were good. Right. They had Zeke Jefferson, the number one quarter miler in the world. You know what I mean? And I went down, my dad and I went on a visit and met Coach Hart. And he said that he would, I guess anyone could walk on at that point. I don't think they allowed you to. And so I loaded up the poles and Coach Hart still tells a story. He said, after I made my breakthrough, Coach Hart said, you know, David, I gave you a full ride. So I saw it in you. And I said, Coach, he said, yeah, I put a full tank of gas in your car.
Full ride.
That's what he said.
Like Coach Hart.
That sounds like Coach Hart.
So why Baylor, and what I mean by that is there was a lot of other good track programs. Yeah. There was a lot of other, I'm trying to think of reading, I wanted to go to Texas. There was a lot of other schools in Texas.
You know, my year before, my dad and I had done a swing through some schools in the South just to look around, and Baylor was one of them. I was born and raised a Baptist, which was a large Southern Baptist school, the largest Southern Baptist school. So that certainly was a reason we stopped as well. Probably meeting Coach Hart as well was something that, you know, at least he gave me the time of day. And so probably those two things. I think that it was the Christian aspect of the school. When I went, I just really felt like I was at home there. And so that was a big deal as well. And they didn't have great facilities. They didn't have anything really. I mean, today they've got first rate facilities and all that. But at the time the track was 5 miles away from campus and it was in a bad part of town and it was, you know, you had to get back and forth. But I still thought that was the best place for me. So that was a fit.
Did you go down as a decathlete, a hurdler, a vaulter?
A hurdler and a vaulter. Yeah.
The hip or?
You know, we did have a guy named Paul Montgomery was coming back and they had recruited two really good intermediate hurdlers out of high school. One guy, a Theron Brown out of somewhere in Texas. I forgot. Sorry, Theron. And then, and he was one of the top in the country in the 300s. And then there's another guy, my roommate, Russell Whitaker. He was a good one as well. We were pretty close in our ability. And then and they were both vying for Theron, Paul. There were three intermediate hurdlers that were good. And Coach Hart just said, hey, David, you know, the chance of you making the travel team, you know, I said, I just can't really carry four quarter hurdlers. And I don't have. He did recruit another vaulter or two and said, but you know, in the vault, I think there's some opportunity there. School record was like 15, six or seven or some crazy number, maybe 16 feet. He had recruited, I was a walk-on, but he recruited Todd Cooper, was from Kansas City area and was he was a top 20 vaulter in the country probably. So he kind of, and he needed a training partner. So it just made more sense. I went ahead and trained for both in the fall, my first year, I think, but then it just made more sense that I concentrate.
And what about academically? You know, you mentioned your dad was an engineer.
Yeah.
Did you go down, were you thinking engineering? As an 18-year-old going in to be a freshman, what was the thought of a career?
Yeah.
I'm going to be an engineer. I'm going to be a business owner. I'm going to be a teacher.
Yeah. Not, boy, there wasn't much thinking. Wasn't much going on up there for that. I'm serious. I went to graduate school and still didn't know what I was going to do for a living. But I the sciences and math, I was really interested in those things. At the time, Baylor did not have, they had a co-op engineering program with Texas A&M.
I think they had engineering, yeah.
And they did, and now they got a great engineering program, but that started just after I left. And so, you know, the closest thing to, I thought, I don't want to go 3 years at Baylor, then go two more to A&M, and I just want to invest all that. And plus, as I started getting better as an athlete, I wanted to stay there because I thought that would be my best chance. And I think I changed my major. I told people five times and graduated on time.
Is that right?
Yeah, five. I started out pre-med. I started out and then I went I wandered all over the planet. Yeah, I actually started in pre-med, believe it or not. Don't ask me why.
18-year-old David Hodge. Yeah. You know, knowing adult David Hodge, that surprises me, like really surprises me. Like,
couldn't
18-year-old,
we were.
We always grow.
Very immature. And I got my undergrad in pole vaulting and then I moved on and figured I better get a decent degree in graduate school. So
now you mentioned how, I'm gonna call it sparse, the pole vaulting was at Baylor. You know, you had recruited Todd and you were working on it. It seemed like that was kind of
until the next year Mike Chaffee joined us. That was the three Bears. So yeah.
You know, when you graduated 4 years later, the vaulting culture was a little bit different.
Yeah.
Did some amazing things. I think at one point, I think Kansas recently did it as well. Three kids from the same school.
Top five.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty far cry from we have one kid we recruited, one kid.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah. Actually, at the, you know, just after I left is a little left beyond that Track and Field News did a historical what's the best school in history, and Baylor was the number one vault school in history. I don't know how they, you have to go back and read the article. Now that's changed, I'm sure, just because some schools have been more, but I don't know, Baylor continues to have great vaulters, but went from kind of nothing to over a 10-year period. I'm not sure when that article was done. Right. But yeah, really.
So what changed? You know, there's a lot of coaches listening right now saying, man, I'd love to have a great hurdle program or vaulting program. I can't get it going. You guys did something. You mentioned Coach Erickson.
Yeah, it was.
What was the recipe? What was the mixture that changed this vaulting culture?
You know, I think Coach Hart he did a great job of just, again, opening the way and getting some athletes. But, you know, the real germ was when Carl showed up. He was just, he was really, he's a unique guy. And he kind of, again, brought a synergy there, or critical mass. Walter started coming and we started getting people, and, you know, we'd have competition, you know, there was rivalry on the team, and there were three 18 foot vaulters on the team. And that's so it was, and from 15-6 or whatever. I mean, we were all, it was an amazing ride. So it was really him. We'd drive to his house and we would train there. He would come into Waco and train us. And we had a co-op with a gymnastics place there in Spring Cove. Like, what was the name of it? Spring Cove. That's wrong. It's a VS. Sorry for Spring Cove guys. Spin Cove. That's what it was. And there in Waco, we did a lot of gymnastics, and we were really kind of cutting edge kind of stuff. And Carl was really, and then later on when they would recruit people, Carl was really the guy that was the attraction, just because he was such a strong coach in Texas, and he was so well known. Yeah.
Now, Coach Hart, and you'll hear the story from the person next week, tells a story of, you know, he was trying to make you a hurdler, you know, 39 to 42. He made mention as well of, like, no, David's not the tallest guy in the world, all these kind of things. You'd gotten hurt somehow. I don't want to tell the story wrong, but maybe you smacked your ankle, and so he says he sent you over to the pole vault to catch poles. And he reminded me, he goes, you know, I used to catch poles. We don't do that anymore, but
I don't know.
And then, you know, after a few weeks, he thought, oh, David might be ready, you know, filled up. And he goes, Mike, I looked over and David's going up on poles. And I feel like I lost him completely to the pole vaulting. You know, I know how special Baylor is to you. And,
sure,
you know, a little insider secret here, you know, Baylor not only is where you found your wife, that's huge enough.
Yeah.
You've had five children.
Five kids.
All go to, I can only hope all my kids go to Troy University. And you've had five. You batted 1,000% going to Baylor.
Yeah.
So it's obviously pretty
small. Not by design, by the way. They all just caught the germ. Not by design. Okay. All right. I didn't.
For some reason.
Yeah.
Did.
Financial reasons.
What was it? You know, I know how I talk about Troy. You know, that's where I found faith. That's where I found, you know, people, passion. What was it about Baylor?
Yeah.
If you were a tattoo guy, you'd have a big Baylor tattoo. It's obviously special in your heart.
Sure.
Why?
You know, first of all, I got to tell the story correctly on Coach Hart. First of all, you know, God bless him, but I got
to hear both versions.
I'm going to tell you the real version. So, I had walked all my first year at Baylor, and I had a pretty nondescript season. I think I jumped 15-1. I barely raised my PR like 7 inches or so. It wasn't any big deal. And then I came out I thought it was so humiliating to walk on 2 years in a row. I thought, well, I felt like somebody who couldn't give up their dream, somebody who just should stop. Come on, David, quit. I mean, you're just not that great. So, and it's just hard for me to admit to that. Came in our first indoor meet and ran down the runway and kind of, you know, do the little jump through the pit, broke my ankle. Never left the ground my sophomore year. And that's what Coach Hart was talking about. I got hurt for sure.
Okay.
And then, you know, I kept lifting while I was hurt. So I kept getting stronger and stronger. And I realized that all I could do, but I realized, you know what? I was always really fast. And I was so much faster than my body weight than my upper body could handle by lifting. It's like it brought them together. And so within, I think that that was indoor missed, of course, all that. I think within 8 weeks, I got to jump as a red shirt and I PR'd by 2 feet.
Wow.
I went from 15 feet to 17 feet.
No more hurdles.
In a night.
Done with the hurdles.
And done with the hurdles. Yeah, I went from 15-1 to 17 feet PR in a night. And what happened was they came together. Like all of a sudden, I was still fast, but my upper body could handle it because I was so much stronger after those 8 weeks of just lifting. So anyway, so that's how I read. And then at that point, I actually earned a scholarship that night. Coach Hart gave me a little bit of a scholarship, and it was a big night. My dad was there. It was really, really a fantastic night.
sorry to cut you off here, David, but you know, I can't go without saying this. And that's an important lesson. And here it is athletically. Sometimes something happens to us and it's the worst, yeah. most devastating thing. Breaking your ankle. Come on. As a track athlete who's trying to earn a scholarship, this is the end of the world. It's done. You do so, you know, what do they say? You can't control what's the outcome, control your response.
Sure.
So you were able to control your response and say, okay, well, then I'll go lift. I'm not going to sit around and do nothing. Mm-hmm. And that ended up becoming really special.
Yeah.
You put PR right off the bat, and then you go on to become multi-time All-American. I mean, that's like there's a lesson for not just athletics, business, personal life, etc. That's really important.
Well, thanks. You know, it was really a special ride. It really was. And I guess going to Baylor was just why was it special to me? I think that the mission of the school, I think the Christian mission, you know, that's really what my life's about. And I feel like it just dovetailed very nicely. Coach Hart really fostered a spiritual environment on the team. I became kind of the, you know, they always pass the mantle on the teams to kind of the spiritual leader of the team, if you will. And so Todd Harbor was the spiritual leader that gave it to me. So he was a fifth year. We actually crossed over. He was a fifth year senior. I was a freshman. And we had this kind of this, you know, track Bible study. And so that guy would always lead the Bible study. And so he passed it to me. And so for 4 years, I was kind of the Bible study leader, and, you know, be on the bus and say, guys, prayer and Bible study at my room, 15 minutes, be there. And, you know, we just have a whole slew of, not everybody, but a slew of people. So I think kind of all that coming together was really special for me that I probably couldn't have done at too many other places.
Right. Sometimes it's hard to put together the ingredients for the recipe and special gets made.
There are some other great Christian schools. I'm sure that environment would be fostered, and they're great secular schools that they do too.
Yeah.
I've got very strong Christian programs and the track team elsewhere, but that for me was just really a special combination.
So I like hearing two sides to, you know, every story has two sides. So next week, we're kind of jumping ahead, but next week, Coach Hart is going to give that story about David, but he also gave us a story. So I want to hear your side and then we can hear the other side. You know, when you're at Baylor, I have to imagine it's kind of a badge of honor to be in the 4x4.
Sure.
There's a reason why we're doing a Baylor 4x4 series.
Yeah.
So it's a, you know, 400 meter U, 4x4, however you want to call it. Amazing, amazing history in that event, in those two events specifically. Coach told us about a time that you were on a relay. It was 4x4, though. And you actually got something that was really cool. You know, a mentor of mine, Bob Lambert from Troy, got a Drake Relays watch.
Oh, yeah.
Shuttle hurdle relay.
Oh, did he really?
The story of how you got a shuttle hurdle, which looks way cooler in my eyes.
Oh, wow.
The shuttle hurdle relay.
I'll tell you what, that was something. You know, I think it was my junior year, or it had been, I had not run the hurdles in probably, it had been three years anyway. Anyway. And we had,
he was desperate.
Yeah. He kind of made his way over to the bolt pit. David, got something to ask you. Anyway. So we had three great hurdlers. They were, you know, 13. We had Renee Thompson. He was a mid low 13 guy. I think he was second or third in the nation. We had, and there were three guys that were all legit sub 14s. Right. And that was it.
You.
Well, they didn't have a fourth.
Right.
And so, Coach Hart said, well, let's just see what it looks like. And so I went over and I could three step. I'm kidding. I could run mid 14s, you know? Right? Yeah. I think that's what
after not running it for so long.
Well, now I did then. Yeah. I did then because in high school, I was probably in the lower 14s, but I'd also grown 3 or 4 inches. I mean, you know, I'd grown. So anyway, it was, I trained for a bit. And so it wasn't like I just walked down to Drake the first day, but it was really funny. Coach Hart, they put me, I anchored it. So he just wanted to humiliate everybody so they would kind of give up because he didn't want them to know how weak their last leg was. And so I was the last, I think we ran semis and finals, or I'm not sure how it worked. But I mean, it was the big guns. Drake at the time was a big time meet. It was big. And so those guys got out in a huge lead. And then Coach Hart said he put his stopwatch away and just said, he started timing by going 9 more hurdles, 8 more hurdles, 7 more hurdles. And I got my split from the Iowa coach. He said, yeah, another guy was a vaulter for Iowa. I'm sorry. He left. I've forgotten his name. Left-handed guy. Anyway, he said he came. He said, "Yeah, my coach," because he was, you know, he was jealous that I was on the other team, and he said, "Yeah, my coach got about mid-14s," and I think he was similar as well. I think that's why he said that. But. So let's
talk about pressure.
Mm-hmm.
We've got 13 really good hurdlers. We want to win the shuttle hurdle relay. Drake really, sure. Drake watch. Here you are in the anchor. There's a lot of pressure, stress. You know, what I love about the relays, we hear the story many, many times in track and field. Someone will run, I'll make up numbers, 50 flat in the open 400. But on a relay, they'll run 48. I think it's because on a relay, we're not running for ourselves.
I've got
three other people that are counting on me, what leg I'm in. So here you are in the anchor. You know, you've got three. You don't want to waste their, you know, you don't want to hit the first hurdle and fall. And it's like, well, those three guys did.
I know.
How did you, again, we're talking about 21-ish year old right now, how did you handle that pressure of like, okay, I can only control what I can control.
Right.
I can only run the hurdles that I run the hurdles. But I got three guys, and my coach, and, you know, people are watching this, Drake Relays.
Yeah.
An important event. How did you step into that pressure and not fold?
Yeah. You know, at that point, I think I was already an All-American once or maybe even twice. So I jumped on TV and done, you know, I've been to the big scene. Yeah. I may have been to a trials even, maybe Olympic trials in the Coliseum. And so I've been to Eugene several times. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't near as pressure as what that would have been. So, and then, you know, the same team went down. We won Texas Relays that same year as well. I don't know why he didn't. Yeah. It's kind of funny. He mentioned that he didn't say.
Where is the Drake Relays watch today?
Oh, it's next to my bed in my nightstand.
Is that right?
That and the Texas one too. They both are. Yeah.
Okay. You graduate.
But yeah.
You also do masters there. Did you?
I did.
Was it vaulting all the way through masters or?
Well, I had you know that when I told you I broke my ankle, I got a redshirt year. Yeah. So actually, I graduated on time, and then my scholarship paid for my first year of graduate school. So when I was a senior vaulting, I was actually. First year graduate school.
Yeah, got it.
So I just stayed on, went to school, and I got my undergrad in finance, and I got my MBA, and so really just stayed on for another couple of years, and then we kind of got, you know, I'll let you kind of unfold it from there if you want.
Well, so you know what next, and what I mean by that is, so you win a few All-American certificates, and until about I think I've told you this, I saw this on Track and Field News about. I don't think it was 10 years ago. Within 10 years ago, so a long time after you've been vaulting here, they always keep, you know, these stats guys for track and field. They keep track of, you know, the top, you know, it's easy to do the top first place, right?
That's
the record. Typically, you know, who's had the highest second place, who's had the
highest. Oh, okay. Place. Yeah.
And until within 10 years, so not that long ago, I think it was fifth place. You had the highest fifth place ever marked in NCAA history in the men's pole vault.
Might have been fourth. I think I was fourth that year. Yeah, I think that was you. I think that was, I forgot where it was. Yeah. You do remember where it was? Yeah.
No, I just had the, you know,
I don't, place. Hodge got I can't by. Remember.
There was some, you know, getting less, you know, athletics.
Well, now I'm sure.
Crazy.
Yeah.
But about 6, 7, 8 years ago, I want to say it was in Oregon. There was just a super deep field.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, all
I'm surprised that lasted as long as it did. That is surprising. Yeah, yeah. I'm shocked.
You get undergrad in finance. You get your MBA.
Yeah.
You meet your wife.
Uh-huh.
You're jumping really well. You love it. We're not the hurdles. You got watches, so you can just retire from the hurdles. And you get to do something that a lot of people want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Not many people get the opportunity to, and that's. Keep vaulting.
Yeah.
What does that look
it was
like?
That's great.
It's crazy to do that in 2024.
Yeah. It was probably easier back then, honestly,
okay.
Because there was a lot more, you know, I'd go to Europe in the summers. A lot of us, I mean, there would be several Americans in Europe. Yeah. I guess that's okay. Yeah. Don't take away my American certificates. Yeah. Well, I actually, I'd put money into an account you had to have through the USATF. Okay. And you had to put the money in the account and whatever. With that said, it was my wife and I was getting ready to finish up graduate school. And I made a U.S. team. It was the U.S. versus Great Britain. It was overseas. And my teammate was Corey Tarpening. And so Corey was an acquaintance. He had beaten me, I think, the year before. He'd gotten second or third, and I'd gotten third or fourth someplace in Eugene. And we got to know each other a little bit. So we were teammates. And he said, you know what? You know, if you know Corey, you know him like this. He said, you know, you need to move out here and train with us. And I was a Nike guy. So I was a promotional athlete for Nike. Okay. And so, and Ante Sheshinski, who had coached two Olympic gold medalists, right, only person to do that, actually. And he was the Nike coach. So there was a kind of a covey of maybe four, five, six vaulters out there. And I said, I called home from London or wherever I was, Glasgow, maybe, I think is where we were. So I said, honey, I think we need to move to Eugene. And she was like, she's a full blood Texan, still a full blood Texan. And she, you know, God bless my wife. You got to know her. She would say, well, David, that's what we're supposed to do. That's what we're going to do. And so we packed him up and moved to Beverly. We moved to Eugene. So I got to train with Nike. And then also, it's really funny, some of the Nike executives, Dick Brown, if you know that name, Dick Brown, he was Mary Slaney's coach. Remember Mary Decker Slaney? So she was American record holder for sure. He was her coach, and he was doing his PhD on kind of the, it was called NYSIS was the company. Icon of Oregon is NYSIS. Anyway, it was about your watch. Yeah, so he basically was objectifying training. So you got points. And anyway, I became their controller, my first job out of graduate school. So it was a bunch of kind of, and then guys on our board were former, like some of the guys that founded Nike were on that board, and got to see Bill Bowerman was on the board. So anyway, I was the controller.
So, you know,
I vaulted.
It's like, it's a really unique place. You know, you could go to a restaurant, Eugene, and your server will be a top 10 miler.
Country,
things like that. It's so interesting. You go out there and you get, you become a controller of a company, and Bill Bowerman on the board.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's just like ingratiation of track and field in everyday life.
You know? Well, Rudy Chapo was my boss. He was a general manager. Yeah. And we had a Harvard MBA was actually the head guy, the CEO, Rick Miller, great guy actually. And then Rudy and myself and another guy. And then I was the controller. So we had, that's a pretty common, you know, it wasn't like, and then Dick Brown was actually, he was the founder. He was the brains guy. I mean, he was the scientist. And so that was my day job. I worked hard. I mean, it was a hard job because it was a startup. Yeah. I'd say, I mean, I'd start work at 6 a.m. in the morning and try to get off by 2. Yeah. So, because I was up at 4 or 5 o'clock every morning, and I would be training. The group started training around 2, and we would train for 2-3 plus hours. Yeah. And I mean, it was a hard life.
So a lot of comparisons to today, like, you know, not a lot of professional track athletes are able to jump full time. They have a job through Nike or whatnot. A lot of them are working, you know, Home Depot,
and
other places. Heck, we've had people here. Continue to train for the Olympics. What was that like? Because it's different going to class and then going to practice.
Yeah.
You get on the bus to go to the track meet on Friday or Saturday. Here you, again, you're married. That's a whole different life.
Yeah.
You have someone else to be responsible for. You're working, so you have responsibility for the company. And you're jumping professionally. You're in track and field, the number one goal is you're trying to make an Olympic team.
You are.
At the same time.
It's a tough.
And
yeah, those guys are living a hard life, especially ones who have to work. Now, you know, there was a level in our day that you could get to if you won a medal, or if you know, you're a top 10 in the world, you could do it full time. Right. Still not going to be rich, but you could, you know. But then for the rest of us, the other 95% of us, we had to do jobs. And so there was no slack in the rope. I mean, I lived an austere, I mean, it was a life of, there was no slack. And my wife and I were very active in our church there too. And so between those things, we didn't do anything else but just kind of get through. My wife was she's a school teacher by education, but she subbed out in Eugene because she didn't have an Oregon certificate. So she would substitute teach in the day, and I would do my thing, and I would come collapse at home at dinner time and do it all again the next day. So it was I my hat goes off to those people. I've lived that life. And then to really make any money, you had to go to Europe. And so I'd say goodbye to my wife for weeks at a time, or 6 weeks or whatever. And you'd hope you jumped well. And I was fortunate. I almost always had really good European summers. I would do well enough to make sense and make some money that we could live on, but not, it's a joke compared to today.
Now, a lot of people aspire to that. You know, when you say it, and even, you know, I have friends that have done it as well. So I kind of cringe a little bit when it's, you know, the weeks in Europe. I still remember a long time ago, my brother, who you
know, yeah, Brian, I do.
He and I were at one of our socials, and Jeff Chwalkin, who's now the throws coach.
Oh, yeah.
At Baylor. And Chewy was telling stories about how he went to Europe, and my brother's just like, oh man, what a life. He just goes over there and throw and make money and all that. And Chewy was like, dude, I come back. If I break even financially, that's a great summer for me.
It was
like, oh, this is not some glorious, you know, driven around and chauffeurs and, you know, show up to the meet and get a big paycheck. It's
tough. Well, there's about three people doing that. The rest of us aren't doing that. We're schmucking on buses, trains, planes, cars, whatever you can do. Boats. I'm going back and forth between Sweden and Finland on boats all the time. I made that trip a million times.
So what, you have a lot of experiences, obviously through Baylor and then up in Eugene, you made some Team USA teams, you went to Europe, things like that. What are, like, can you think of, like, putting you on the spot here a little bit, like just a ridiculous story. Like, you know, we hear about vaulters, traveling with your poles. Anytime that you had to borrow poles you had to jump in a snowstorm. I don't know.
Yeah.
I know you have a lot of
experiences
and stories.
You know, it's funny. One of my early breakthroughs, I think it was maybe just my second time over, my second or third time over. And I had jumped in Indianapolis at the USATF meet. It wasn't called that thing. It's called TAC then.
Oh, yeah, TAC.
TAC, yeah. So it was called the same meet, but TAC at Indy. And we had gotten in a car that night and drove to like St. Louis or something from Indy. What we long drive, and it was the former university, the really good 1500 meter guy from University of Chicago, the head coach there, Jim Spivey. He was in the car with me, Jim Spivey and someone else. There was like probably three or four. I think we were all going to Europe, drive all through the night after the meet, catch a plane in St. Louis, fly over. Well, I had to be with Todd Cooper and probably Carl Erickson. I think were with us too. Flew over, got somewhere in some Chibokan town of Sweden, or I think, and our poles didn't make it. And I thought all that, and you know, this God bless this Swedish guy we'd gotten to know. Well, I think it was the top Swede at the time, and he had a pole that was similar to size of what I needed, and it was just slightly smaller than my bread and butter pole, slightly smaller. And man, I rocked on that pole. I PR'd that night, I jumped 18, 4.5. I think it was my first time over that. And then I won a bunch of meets. And then my pole showed up. I got back on my pole and I got tired too, but also I didn't jump as well. So as long as that guy was at the meet, I was good. I was rocking.
So I have, you know, so much admiration for vaulters for the travel side of it. I mean, it's
crazy.
It's amazing. You know, our teammate Tim Glover, when he was in college,
yeah,
two-time national champion,
yeah,
and he shows up for NCAA's one year, and the airline did a pole vault. They just snapped all of the
javelins. Yep. Yep.
You know, he's an undergrad. He's calling, you know, his coach, Eric Whitsitt, now at University of Tennessee, calls. And he's like, send us the picture. And, you know, you get that picture on your phone. And I can't imagine how you guys feel about it when it happens. Because, you know, I'm not a vaulter or a javelin thrower. And I see it and my heart just sinks.
It does.
It's amazing. So traveling with vaulting poles, get out of here, man. That's just
ridiculous. It was. And, you know, it was just exhausting, too.
Sure.
You know, we knew all the kinds of trains and which side of the train we knew which side we had to be on because the window opened enough to get our poles in. And then the boats. And then I'm not kidding. You had to learn in the buses, you had to learn like all the particulars of the Swedish train versus the Finnish train versus the Danish train. Because again, the windows would open just enough that we could get the poles while it stopped because it was going to take off.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Speed was an element.
So you're jumping professionally, starting a family. So that means you're going for the Olympics, which means the Olympic trials, the toughest meet in the world, in a lot of aspects, especially maybe during this time for vaulting.
Sure.
How did it go?
Yeah. You know, I was in 84. I just really made my breakthrough that year. And I was a sophomore was my sophomore season at Baylor, and I had really just, I improved kind of from that. I'd gone from my freshman year to from that 15-foot vaulter to I've improved all the way up to, 3 feet. And so I went into the trials, the top collegiate, and I thought I got it. I wanted to make the final. It was really my goal was to make the final. And I didn't make, I was, Mark started my, we have a great story. Mark listens to this. He'll love the story. So, Brad Pursley is, they're going to take 12 to the final. If Brad misses his last jump, he's not jumping very good. If he misses his last jump, then Mark and I go, cause we were sitting on 13th, the two of us, we were tied at 13th. And if Brad makes it, then we're done.
Right.
And so we're there holding each other like a couple of girlies. And sure enough, rattled the bar. And so we got to go home, didn't make the final, which, was really kind of what I didn't have aspirations of making the team,
sure.
But I was a clean guy. And I knew there were some suspects, and I thought, if guys are coming off stuff, but then I heard there was a different deal. So with that said, then the next time I'd moved to Eugene, and I already had one knee surgery from football in high school, and my knee just started kind of breaking down, and I had to have surgery. And so I was actually on my back during surgery, having surgery. So, and then at the end of that, I was, the next year, the year after when I retired, I think I retired the next year, the year after, I was fifth at the USATF. So, the next year was world champs, I think. And I could have hung on, I would have been one of those, there's always a sleeper that makes the team. And I could have been that sleeper. I wouldn't have been an odds-on favorite by any stretch, but I would have been a guy that would have been in the hunt for sure. So,
how do you know? I don't have this. I was forced into retirement. I graduated high school.
Yeah.
So there was no.
Oh, I get it. Yeah.
Decision for me.
Yeah.
We're kind of going this through with our teammate Tim Glover.
Yeah, we are.
Javelin throwers. He's like, man, do I go one more?
Everybody does. Yeah.
3 years, because you almost have to make like 4-year decisions. The Olympics are important. That is
you do.
Sport. How did you know?
Yeah, great question. I'm still wondering
there's a robust master's.
Yeah, oh boy, man, it'd be awful robust for me. Woo, that'd be embarrassing. It was a pretty obvious decision for us. My wife and I had been there about 3.5 years, and we were kind of locked in. We were going to go to the next Olympics. I thought, I had a job. We were kind of working. But then we had our first child. So Heather was born, and she was a one-year-old. And I had gone to, that summer was when I got fifth. And so I packed up and went to Europe. And my best European summer as well. It was a great year. I got home within about a week. I laid myself off my job. I was a finance director of a little larger company called Excel Sport Science, still a very small company. And it really couldn't afford an MBA or a guy like me. And so I laid myself off. Nike laid off Andrzej Szyszynski, and he went back to Europe. I think he went and coached the English. I think he went to the English national team. And, my wife and I looked at each other kind of one night, and we just thought, I think this is the Lord. This is it. And then it goes into dovetails into the Gill story. I don't know if you want to talk about that or not. But regardless, I was interviewing for another job there that was kind of assistant controller of a paint company. And, it was just a little bit like. And then, I was just kind of on hold as far as my career is concerned. I mean, I was doing things, but I thought I didn't know what I wanted to do still. And with a baby, so I put the feelers in the water for a consulting company like Arthur Anderson at the time, Accenture now, I think. And I'd kind of talked about going to work for them, and we interviewed with them, and I actually interviewed with Gil as well. And so that's kind of was just like, there really wasn't. I could have stayed out there, but at that point, it would have been life altering. It was one thing to kind of play at it. I was young. Hey, I've still got plenty of room for my career. But at that point, I'd been like, okay, we're going to stay here, and I'm going to become a pole vaulter that's going to change my life. And I just wasn't willing to do that.
And track is one of those things, track athletics, the actual being the athlete, mm-hmm. Especially at this level. Like if you're trying to make the Olympics,
yeah,
point blank, if you're trying to make the Olympics as a Team USA member, mm-hmm. it's an all or nothing.
Yeah.
I don't know that anybody's ever made the team that was 50%, 90%, 50%.
Yeah.
were you able to make the clean break from it? When you and Amy were like, yeah, I think everything's kind of coming together, that this
yeah.
is, was there ever like that? Yeah, but maybe I can still.
Yeah. You know, I did. I had that same part of that story. I'd come back from Europe and I had stopped to see my parents in Mount Vernon. And I was making my way back to Eugene. I just stopped. I'm coming back from whatever, somewhere in Europe. And Tim Winder was in Chicago and he said, hey, David, why don't we meet halfway at Parkland and we'll just, let's just meet and we'll maybe go see where our poles are made. I'll stop in and see Gil.
Did you know of Gil?
No. No, I was a pacer. They owned Pacer, right. And I was a pacer of Alter.
That's right. Yep.
So I was a promotional athlete.
Yeah, but you didn't know Gil as far as like Champaign Urbana, even though how close it was.
You know, I knew of it, but not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Never. Okay. And I stopped in and Tim and I went and just kind of showed up and John Moret, Skip, the owner of the company, met me. He's like, David, all these years you've jumped for us. And, you know, they treat me really well. And I took off, went back to Eugene, not knowing that in the next week, all those things were going to happen. I was going to lose my job. I was going to lose my coach. And then Skip called me about a week later and said, hey, David, you told me about a product that you were working on. I wanted to see if you can. And then I said, well, that was just my old job. That was my old job. And he said, you say old job? And I said, yeah. And he said, David, we're looking for a controller. We can't find a controller that fits.
Wow.
He said, would you be interested? I hear you're a finance guy. Oh. And my wife and I had been praying about, God, what are we going to do here?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's it. I flew in here the next week and interviewed the week after that.
Wow.
So with Tim and I had not met here that summer.
Right.
We wouldn't have, I wouldn't even know the job's available. So,
you know, it's funny, you've heard me share my story and I talk a lot about, I have the vision in my head of, you know, God's hand on my back, like, all right,
yeah,
Mike's time to go here. And
yeah,
Mike's time to go here. And
yeah,
for some reason he said, Mike's time to go to Vegas, you know, those kind of things. And I think of that same thing there with that story. It's like, you easily could have said, hey, let's meet halfway, Kankakee. Let's meet halfway, Effingham.
It was.
Let's come to Chicago.
Uh-huh.
Chicago, come on. It's awesome
sure.
out there. And
we stopped there.
Of
yeah.
Yeah.
So Amy and I thought that was a big, and then I was interviewing with Arthur Anderson as well, but it was, you know, they were really slow. We needed to eat, you know, I tell my kids this thing called the eating principle. You need to, and we needed to. And while we had money, we just knew it was running out, you know, we made doing nothing. So, Arthur Anderson was not going with the eating principle very well. And so that's why I took the job here.
Well, you know, if you're listening here, you know, I've coached David. There's actually three kind of amazing parts to his life here as it relates to Gil. And we really only wanted to do today the one. So this is going to kind of wrap us up. I do have one more question to kind of tie it all together, though. When you think about, you know, as we're in this Baylor 4x4 series, I know how important Coach Hart is to you.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you've ever visited us here at the factory in Champaign, Illinois, you know, we have rooms, meeting rooms, much like we're in here recording this podcast, that all are named after people that were influential in either our sport or specifically in our company. Mm-hmm. So little known secret, I record in what we call our media room. It's the Bowerman mm-hmm. media room. Bill Bowerman was pretty influential in our sport, and we right. wanted to honor him. We have others, you know, with our basketball line and things like that, and other aspects. And one of our rooms, our training room, which, you know, kind of funny that I just put that together for some reason, but is the Hart
right.
training room. So that's one way that, you know, you as a CEO have honored him.
Mm-hmm.
And then right outside, and I've shared this on my Twitter before, we have this very large quote from Coach Hart as well. It's, of course, escaping my memory as I say that, but I might have to do this on Twitter the day that
I walk by it all the time too.
I know. Yeah,
sorry.
But it's the only big quote in this whole
factory,
by the way.
Yeah.
I just realized. What have you, you know, Coach Hart taught you a lot of things.
Sure.
Not necessarily how to run faster or jump higher, although, you know, obviously some of those things too, but he taught you about faith, family, love, and passion. You know, run this joint, I always say, on a daily basis, you know, oversee, you know, hundreds of people here and have seen hundreds of people who have come through here and worked and been blessed to work here with us. What are some of the principles? Like, when you think about what you do on a daily basis, and I know how you're a very mission-focused leader here, What are some of the aspects that you learned from Coach Hart, learned from Baylor mm-hmm. itself? What mm-hmm. are some of the things that you put into principle yeah. as we start to wrap up our Baylor
yeah. course years? You know, I think that Coach Hart is a man of excellence. And I think that he, you know, there's people who just leave things to chance. And Coach Hart is someone who, that's not Coach Hart. He's a guy who's well-prepared. His athletes are well-prepared. He's also, you know, Coach Hart, you know this, but there are no dumb Hall of Famers. He is a very bright, and he thinks through things very well and is well-prepared. And so, you know, I hope around here that we're doing the right things over and over and over again. We don't always, but we sure try to. And I think that preparation and I think that, you know, you've got to work hard. You can't just flip a coin or hope more. There are strategies, there's risks. There are things you got to do. You know, when Coach Hart was training all these great athletes, there are risks you take in the right workouts, the right resting period, the right pushing period. And I think that those things are really, they're going to pay you back. And I hope around here that we're trying to be very principled. And again, kind of the old good to great kind of thing where we're doing the right things over and over and over again. And eventually that gets critical mass and it becomes very easy. It looks easy. It's not. It is easy now, but we've had a lot of hard work. And I think a lot of times those athletes, the Michael Johnsons and all the Jeremys, and it may look easy out there just because they put the work in and they've done a lot of great things over and over again.
Yeah. I'd add one aspect, because, you know, I have the luxury of, I've already interviewed Coach Hart, which everybody, you'll be able to listen next week with that. Another aspect that he talked about that I see a lot in your leadership and in our DNA here, you know, as a total company, you know, we know of Coach Hart and Baylor Way and how to train for year runners today, but that's not how Coach Hart trained early in his career.
He
had to learn it. Exactly. He had to humble himself enough to know that, okay, maybe I don't know it all. And he was producing champions, by the way, before this, and started researching and studying and pushing the envelope forward with training until he continued to craft what became, what Michael Johnson became. And then, you know, there's a list of 20 deep of 400 meter runners from Baylor. You know, of course, Mike Ford, Dion Myman, Jeremy.
Over and over.
There's a billion. I'm going to forget them all. I see that in us as well. You know, I've heard you say this, and, you know, I trumpet this as well. You know, we will unapologetically push the envelope. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know this story. We were at NCAA's 1 year, pretty recently, last couple of years, because this involves our continuum CFOT. And we're out at the practice area, and I go talk to Edric Florial. Flo knows, right? Yeah. University of Texas. And Flo goes, "So that's your new hurdle, huh?" And I was like, "Yeah, what do you think?" He's like, "Man, you guys, you always pushing technology, y'all always moving forward." And I go, "Yeah, coach." I go, "You know, if we didn't, we'd still be taking troughs and figuring out our starting
blocks."
He goes, "Yeah, you know, you're right."
That's great.
I was like, "Always have to push." You know, but anyway, you know, saying that, and I'm like, "Flo, I've seen you train your athlete. You're always pushing."
Oh yeah.
Your athlete, so it's exactly
you have to
what we continue to do. Absolutely.
Competitive
well,
world.
David, thank you so much. You know, this is it's a lot of fun. You know, I really, again, so grateful that you allow me to do this. But I sit in a pretty unique seat. You know, we're at episode 250. So I've interviewed 250 plus coaches from middle school to professional level, all in between, professionals like yourself as well. And so it's kind of a little bit selfish here. I learn a lot from that. So grateful to learn your story and share your story. I'm hopeful that we'll get you back on the show in the next year or so, because you know, your history here at Gill, we went up to Gill.
Sure.
You know, your history at Gill is when you talk about faith and trust and support and love and family, you know, I know how important the family, your family has been in with us as well. There is no better story. And I know I live it. I know I'm biased 100%, but I hope to one day get you back on and share that story. I think, you know, our audience of mainly track coaches would be interested in that.
Right.
And then, you know, because I think a lot of people have interest in what we do here. And there's a little bit of, you know, not everybody gets to visit the factory to actually see what, you know, black magic. I still don't, you know, my head, I can't see this stuff. It's amazing. Steel comes in, welded, cut it, painted, voila, there's a pretty football standard. That's just voodoo to me. It's quite amazing. But I would like to have you on the show maybe one day, again, in the forward future. to talk about, okay, so what is GIL? What's the future look like for GIL? What are we like? What's our mission? What every day, the people that come to work at this place, what are we trying to accomplish every single day? So I'd love to have you on to kind of talk about that one.
I'd be happy to. Thank you for having me. It's been really a pleasure. Obviously, I love just hanging out with you. So I hope that people have enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Well, keep listening. So next week, I can't stress enough, we've got some amazing coaches, and I don't ever rank these guys and gals, but everybody from a Brooks Johnson, George Williams, Dave Smith from Oklahoma State, amazing high school coaches. It's really amazing, the back library, the back catalog that we have here. And next week, it's Coach Hart. And I can't tell you, I just can't express his storytelling, his history. The man ran 9.9 in the 100-yard. That blew me away right there alone.
He still has a Baylor record in the 100 because he won't let him run.
I don't know why I thought he was a quarter miler.
No,
you've got to hear his story as we continue in season 5. We started this in January of 2020.
Wow.
Never would have thought the word season 5 was coming out of my mouth. And we got some really amazing special things coming up this year. I'm so thankful and honored that you would be here to listen to us. So join us next week and we'll do it all over again. Thanks, everybody.
The goals to appreciate the coach, the ones who point people most. Every season needs a voice of reason, speaking the growth. Got a prep for you, carry the load. It's coffee to the soul for those of us who stay on the go. Proper handoff to stay in the zone. What you packing for the road? There's more than one way to the goal. Take notes, that's paying your toll. It ain't practice if your purpose ain't clear. It can't happen till you listen with both ears. Can't mentor without a mentor's years of experience, so you can reinvent those years. Every plan's got a standard to live up to. And the price, sacrifice, can you give up you? It's a choice and a fight, not a win or lose. It's not a ploy, but advice so y'all can make more moves. It's not about how to, it's all about why. You don't know till you know who you are inside. 6 million ways to tie, choose none. So we all cross the finish line, the work ain't done. So we learn from the experts, we all gotta put in the legwork. GIL Athletics is a network, it's all about connections. Put together for the profession, to every track coach could be blessed.